All right, in C++ world again. Who are you guys?
So I'm George Malika. I'm a developer on the VC++ libraries team.
Cool.
Well, and I'm Ben Anderson, and I'm on the C++ libraries team too. I'm a tester, so I write automated tests.
Cool. So you try to break his code, and then you try to fix.
Yes, always. Ben always comes up with interesting ideas and scenarios.
Yes.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about what are your specialties? Like today, what are we going to focus on? Deployment? What does that mean?
So what we wanted to talk about today, like Ben and I, is basically to explain to people how VC is using Fusion and how are these things playing together. Like, how are our assemblies actually playing with the application that the user builds? Mm-hmm. And comes with that, how can these two pieces play together well on the end user's machine? Like once the developer has built his application using our libraries,
mm-hmm.
and now wants to deploy his application on an end user's machine, how he should go about that and what's the best practice for that so his application doesn't break.
I guess to take a step back, the problem that people face that they don't always realize until they're actually shipping their application is that, you know, Visual C++ and Visual Studio doesn't ship with Windows. It's not, you know, they're out of sync, and like if you want to use anything from Visual C++, somehow you have to get, you know, those libraries that you're going to use onto your user's machine so they can use them. So, that's the basic problem. People often assume it should just work when they move their application there, but your application actually uses a lot of code if you use. If you write in C++, you're using the C runtime. If you write in C, you're probably using the standard template library or standard C++ libraries, or you might be using MFC and things. But to get those versions that you're using from, you know, Visual Studio 2005 or 2008 that just shipped, you have to get those libraries somehow onto your end user's machine so that your application will actually run and can call all the things that it wants to call.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's the same kind of thing even for .NET developers with when they include assemblies on their dev machine. They have to, of course, it's a lot easier in .NET because you simply just say, you know, I want to take this library and build it as part of the package that I'm going to ship this application in. Is it different for C++? Let's talk about the complexities that you guys face.
So, I mean, in a sense, it's just as easy. It's just you have more options. So, .NET, you dump this huge thing on people's machines that's like 30 megs and takes an hour or whatever to install.
Uh-huh.
C++ has been evolving for a long time, so there's like a series of options, and I mean, maybe that's the thing we should go through is, yeah,
sure,
what are your options to get your libraries on your customer's machine besides just dumping some giant Redis executable on them?
Certainly. Well, I mean, let's talk about that because that clearly is the problem that customers do face with C++ today, yes? Thus,
yes.
We're having this conversation.
Yes, true. So, we were thinking about that, and we thought, like, maybe we should start first by explaining the pieces that are involved in all this thing.
Absolutely.
And then after that, we can explain what are the deployment options and where are the points of failure, basically,
sure,
that most people hit.
Great.
Sure. So can we use the board?
Of course.
Cool.
Okay. This is Channel 9, man. The whiteboard is key.
So, yeah, basically, I mean, what you end up with, you know, when you write your program is, like, your executable and DLLs, but your binaries. Is that the right kind of your... Yes, that's the right your... So, like, how do you see the typical one on .dll, .ocx, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you write those, you end up using some libraries and things, like C++ or whatever. So you end up having, you know, C++ libraries that you depend on. And they live over here, right? They're not part of your thing. They're things that are already written. So, so this would be, like, MFC, ATL... C runtime.
That you'd expect to be on the machine.
Sure,
right?
Yeah, and some versions of those are, but I mean, if you're using Visual Studio 2005, I mean, you probably want some of the new features like the secure CRT functions.
Absolutely.
For instance, or whatever. So those aren't going to be on Windows 2000 or Windows XP, but, mm-hmm. or anything that ships after that. So what we're talking about now is like how do you get these things onto your user's machine? So what are the, you know, possible ways you can make sure you have the access to those when you're running? So, like, the most basic, and I don't know if this is actually the oldest way of doing it, but so there's one way of doing it, which is to statically link everything in. So stuff you use from here gets pulled into your XE. So that's okay. That's called static linking. And I think all the C++ libraries support that unless you're using any sort of .NET stuff, and then they don't let you do that anymore. But so that's basically if you're using cl.exe, that's the /mt option. And I mean, we sort of say this isn't really a very preferred way of doing things because it means every exe and every DLL will have pieces of these libraries pulled into it. So your users only really need, people only need one copy on their machine. They don't need to pull those into their every binary that they run. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that because it's statically like stuck inside your binary, say like there's a security fix or something,
mm-hmm.
You don't get that fix unless you recompile your program and redistribute it and ship it every binary that say there's a fix in here. In the
sure,
library.
Absolutely.
So say like printf has some horrible bug or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get those fixes for free. Under static linking, you have to recompile and ship every single binary that you.
Understood. So clearly, that's not a preferred method.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah. So in general, especially for bigger, programs where you maybe have a couple DLLs and XEs, we really don't recommend anybody do static linking. And there's probably some scenarios where it's the right thing to do, but in general, I don't think that's the right thing to do. So then there's this other option, which is or family of options where you somehow get DLLs that contain all of this code on your customer's machine. And in .NET, you get those by, running the .NET redist and installing all of .NET on your user's machine.
Sure.
For C++, there's a couple options. One of those is to install this executable that people keep finding called VC redist. And then it has an architecture, like x86 or x64.
Okay.
And .exe. And that's just an MSI inside of .exe that installs and drops all these guys on your user's machine. Really, I mean, the only reason we ship this is for packages like, what's it called? What's the installer framework that?
When's the installer?
Sorry?
When's the installer?
MSI? Yeah.
No, sorry. For sort of bootstrapper installers that
okay.
need, that are like in systems for keeping your applications.
ClickOnce.
Yeah, ClickOnce, that's the name.
Got
right.
it.
So ClickOnce uses this to install it. You can use it too, but there's a few drawbacks that I would say. One thing is it installs all of the libraries. You probably only need, one or two of them at the most on your user's machine. The other thing is that, in add remove program files, your users will see this entry that says Visual C++ Redis, and they'll be like, what's that? And they
don't want them to uninstall.
Yes, they might uninstall it. You can't ever uninstall it because you don't know if somebody else also tried to install it and is depending on it.
Mm.
So it's sort of just stuck on your user's machine, and it's not very discoverable for them even when they can uninstall it because they'd have to check all their applications and decide, yes, I do or don't need it. So, that's one option, and we see people using it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just because conceptually it's simple to understand.
And for that option too, actually the other point is when users try to, not users, sorry, like if a third party picks up our libraries and distributes it to the users and they decide to choose the VC Redis as a way of distributing our stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So for them actually to be able to be logo compliant, they have to, when they uninstall their own software from their user's machine, they have to uninstall the VC Redist as well.
Hmm.
Because they need to restore the machine to its original state. And while this is doable for them, there isn't a problem with that, but if two applications are actually installing the VC Redist on the machine, and one of them, because it wants basically to be logo compliant, uninstalls the VC Redis, the other applications that depended on it
mm-hmm.
will be actually broken.
Mm.
So this is a really bad scenario, and
absolutely.
That's why VC Redis, although it's kind of very tempting for a lot of people because it's really easy to use. You just double-click the executable
uh-huh.
or like launch it and you're set up and you're done.
Sure.
So this is kind of not a very recommended way either for now.
Mm-hmm.
We are considering changes to V3 Redis to make it more robust and more usable.
Yeah.
But at this point, this is one of the major drawbacks besides what Ben was just referring to.
Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah, so this is all a description of how things work now. But we can talk maybe later about, you know, improvements that could be made and things like that. So that's the deal. Another option you have is to Redis your DLLs locally into your application folder, which is sort of a lot like statically linking. And this is sort of, you know, the traditional way of doing things before Windows Side-by-Side or Fusion came along. It's slightly different now that there's Windows Side-by-Side and Fusion. So there's basically these folders under, like, program files, the Visual Studio directory, I don't remember the whole path, and then VC, and then /Redis. And there's folders for each of these libraries that contain the DLLs and a manifest file describing the version of the DLL. And you can drop those folders basically everywhere you have a binary that depends on them, and because it looks in its local directory, and it'll say, hey, I see that I have this DLL, this version number, I can use it. So I guess one way of describing that is there's two words people call it, but often people will describe that as app local deployment. And this sort of all falls under the DLLs distribution mechanism. And this way, you know, you can just get just the files you want. You can x-copy things onto machines. It'll just work. You don't have to run any installer. Like, smaller tools and things often. This is probably a good way of getting the DLLs onto machines where maybe people don't have administrator privileges, so they can't run installers. Maybe you're part of an IT organization where all your machines are pretty locked down, but you need to get a tool onto people's machines that, or that they need to run from a network share or something like that. So this is a good option for those people. It's a little more complicated. I would say it's like harder to deal with than most of the other options. And then really, I think for us, the preferred method for almost everyone, you know, the normal scenario where you have an application, it's okay to have an installer, it's okay to require admin privileges, is we ship these things that Windows installers, MSIs, can consume called MSMs, which is the file extension, and they're also called merge modules. And those are just modules that MSI installers can consume, so when you build your installer, it will install the things that are inside these, and those will drop the DLLs. These contain the DLLs. There's one for each library, you know, C++, CRT, and MFC.
Okay.
And those will drop drops the DLLs into sort of like the central Windows side-by-side store on people's computer. And that's usually in, you know, whatever Winder is.
Okay.
WinSXX. And this is sort of the way we generally recommend people do it, because then you can get just the libraries you need, installs it centrally, and ref counts it. So, like, if several applications, you know, install the MSMs, there will only be one copy ever in your computer. It'll just bump the ref count up each time, and as they uninstall, once the ref count hits zero, and nobody's depending on the library, it will get pulled off of your customer's machine.
Cool. So is that sort of, you know, kind of equivalent to, in the managed world, the GAC?
Yes, the WinSideBySide folder is pretty much equivalent to the GAC.
Yeah.
And it's under Windows control and Windows protection, and only like administrator can install files under actually the WinSideBySide folder. Mm. And it's completely managed by Windows. Like, even in order to copy stuff here, like in order for us to install the files to this folder, we have to call Windows APIs that install it and control the whole process.
So now what happens with, you know, say, for example, one app needs to install inside of the MSM repository, that Windows Win side by side. A version of DLLX that's been updated that might break
another application on the app that doesn't want the update. I mean, usually you don't break things in a backward direction.
Sure.
Yes.
And hopefully, if you've done it right. But yes, we all know that isn't always the case. So my assumption is that if a newer version of DLLX is installed into the WinSYS, everyone then gets that version. Or can you say, I want to use an older version?
So basically, in order to be able to install the C runtime and the WinSYS folder, this has to be coming from us.
Okay.
And we are, like, based on the Fusion terminology, we are like the assembly publishers in this case.
Mm. So Fusion is the same thing as Windows side by side.
Yes,
it's just
a cooler name.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yes.
And that scenario, when we basically ship our RTM for mm-hmm. VC9, for example, we say, okay, our assembly is VC9, let's assume it's 9.0, for example.
Okay.
And then we release a QFE after that. Okay, that QFE will be 9.1, for example. Mm-hmm. And we release along with it a policy that will redirect from the older version to the newer version. And this means that any application that shipped basically before we shipped our QFE mm-hmm. and depended on the 9.0, which is the RTM version, mm-hmm. will now be using the 9.1.
Okay,
now it's our responsibility that 9.1 mm-hmm. is compatible with 9.0.
Sure.
During the servicing period of RTM. But if we move to a newer version, like VC10, for example, mm-hmm. they are no longer compatible. And there is no way actually for a redirection even between mm-hmm. them, because Windows Fusion will actually even not allow the redirection between like 9 and 10. And we are always, we're not counting on having them binary compatible in most cases.
So, but let's step back, for example, what does that mean necessarily, that the policy of the underlying system won't allow a transfer? So I guess what I'm saying is, do I have to recompile my application with the new libraries?
No, you don't have.
But it's going to be transparent to me as an application.
So there's two questions. George is saying it's not redirecting from, say, VC9 to VC10, right?
Okay.
And that's intentional, because VC10 will change, you know, the structures and the functions and the classes that live in those DLLs. So if you're, like, trying to, say, talk back and forth between your VC9 C string and your VC10 C string, VC10 has this new member variable, so copying memory and back and forth, you'll just get completely hosed.
Understood.
So in that sense, like, you know, doing those breaks allows us to add functionality and to change things, adding the version numbers. So basically, at that level, it's not binary compatible anymore, so redirecting is sort of meaningless.
Understood.
So, within a version, we make the commitment that everything we'll ship will be binary compatible. And if for some reason we didn't do that, we would not make that redirection anymore. So that
does beg the question, in the sense that if I'm a VC9 app,
right,
or a 9.0 app,
sure,
and it turns out that there's a security flaw in one of the, you know, God forbid, secure CRT libraries,
sure,
and it's fixed in the 10 version for sure, but my app, because it's 9, is still hitting a flawed library. Are you going to does the C++ team build a 9.3 to fix my problem, or do they expect me to recompile my app in VC10?
Yeah, we'll definitely build a 9.3, like you're saying. So yeah, we'll build another version of 9 with security fixes.
Cool.
As long as it's within servicing lifetime or whatever. In the software world, it's like forever. It's like 5-10 years. So.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't require the users to rebuild their application by any chance, because mm-hmm. this is the role of the policy redirection, which basically says, okay, anybody who's asking for version like 9.0, mm-hmm. okay, point them to this new version, which is 9.3, for example. And if we release even another patch after that, another fix, mm-hmm. like 9.4, we'll release another policy that says, okay, everything from 9.0 until actually 9.4 can be using 9.4. And this way we guarantee that everybody will be pointed to the most recent.
And to make the distinction, that applies to all these DLL things.
Okay.
Not static linking. If you're static linking, you have to go recompile your app with the fix and
that's no fun.
And reship it every. Yeah. I mean, and depending on what your app looks like, it could be a lot of DLLs and a lot of XEs. So, so really, if there were a security flaw, we can drop DLLs on every machine that uses Windows Update, right, mm-hmm. into the Windows side-by-side store where they can get everybody redirected to the updated DLLs. Mm-hmm. We can't do anything for you if you're statically linking, because that's inside your XE. We can't touch that for obvious legal reasons. Like
sure. People. Well, don't statically link, people. I mean, do you find many of your customers are statically linking?
We don't think so. Most yeah. people are using DLLs, yeah. basically.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's cool about DLLs.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes,
I mean, sure it's true that it makes things simpler if you statically link. And there are, when we talk to people, there are people who do it. I think their reasons are basically, for doing it, are basically invalid. But, I mean, so some of the reasons we come across are it's simpler. Some people say that, well, I don't want to distribute the whole DLL, and the linker is smart enough when I statically link to only pull in the things I want, so my application is now 90K instead of a megabyte. Mm. And, I mean, in today's world, you know, there's the principle of being small, and there's whether you actually need to be that small. And for, I would say, 99% of people, there's no way they really need to have a 90K thing instead of a 1 meg thing.
Well, unless their application targets a mobile device.
Sure. And in those cases, you know, there's a different set of mobile DLLs, and there's a different set of things who are...
Is there a different sort of madness map like this?
I would assume it's completely different. Yeah. It's a different team. It's not our team. Who builds the mobile...
Sure, that must be challenging, because you force people to be in small worlds. But that's just by design, because that's the platform.
Right, yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, I guess like, one of the questions I'd ask is, like, how does this work from a... What, like, from the C engine perspective, like...
From perspective of, like, compiling and linking...
Yeah, so, I mean, because there's a lot of magic you guys are doing, or Sam Drucker calls it heavy magic, which is a new favorite word, but...
Yes, so maybe I can use some of the whiteboard.
Of course.
So, try to use this part.
Cool.
So, basically, it starts with... So, this is the dev machine. Okay. And basically, on the dev machine, he will have Visual Studio installed, which installs basically the VC libraries. Okay, and the VC libraries consist of headers. Okay, and then import libraries. Mm-hmm. And then DLLs. Okay, and then here is the user code, basically. So, some something.cpp and something else.cpp. Okay, and what happens is his code includes wants to use our libraries, so he basically includes our stuff, so he brings everything in here.
Yep.
Okay, and then those guys go through the compiler. Okay, and we generate OBJs. Okay, and these two go through the linker. Okay, and they generate basically the executable or the DLL. Okay, and the linker also takes the import library, so it knows that it should be using the DLLs. And these two pieces at the very end, like the DLLs from the library and the executable that the user has built, or the DLL, are the runtime components that he's willing to distribute, or he's planning to distribute to the end end user. Now, in order to... So this has been always the model for like C++ for a very, very long time. Now, where Fusion fits into that, or how we kind of do the version...
So I don't mean to interrupt you, so because I know where we are, we're talking about how Fusion fits into this, and we're in Linker and Exit. What I have to do now is clear up a little more room on my...
Okay.
I just got back from Europe, and it's full. This, of course, will be on the interview, so everyone knows this is happening.
Okay.
I'm just going to clear some files, and we'll come right back on.
Okay.
All right? All right, we're back, and we're recording. So where were we?
Okay, so we were saying that this is basically the model for C++ that's been there for, like, a long time.
Forever.
And now, since actually VS8, we changed this slightly, added stuff in a bunch of places to make it actually work with Fusion. And what we did is the first thing we said, okay, so this is the library that the user is building against. Mm-hmm. So we want to give it more than just the regular version that ends up in the DLL. So we decided to give it, like, the assembly identity, which consists basically of, like, a bunch of things. The most important two pieces are basically the name of the assembly, okay, and the version. So
okay.
That header that the user code will include will contain these two pieces. Basically, let's say it's a CRT assembly. So I'm going to write all the fusion information in red. So it's kind of
cool.
And then CRT, and then we'll say it depends on CRT version, let's say 3.
Okay.
Okay. So when this gets compiled, the compiler sees this information, and we have a directive basically that will make this information persist here in a way. So we'll have CRT 3 in this object also, and this one. Okay. And then when the linker sees this information, mm-hmm. okay, it will create a manifest for that executable or DLL, and it will say, okay, I depend, or that binary depends on CRT3. Okay, and because this is one unit that we shipped, so we guarantee that if the headers say at CRT3, the DLLs are 3. Okay,
cool.
And then we also added a bunch of files for it to be an assembly, which are basically a manifest file. So it says also I am CRT version 3. Okay, and then a catalog file for signature verification. So that's not important because it's a binary file we don't read. And this unit is called like an assembly. The DLL plus the manifest that identifies which assembly that is, and the catalog. Okay, so in that case, if we just look at these two, like this one and this one, we'll see that, okay, this is an assembly that's identified by the manifest file, and it's called CRT version 3. And here we have a binary that depends on a manifest that's called CRT3.
Mm.
Okay, so this is how those linked up together. This manifest could be external, like an external file, which is the name of the executable .manifest,
mm.
or it could be embedded as a resource inside the binary. Okay, and in both cases, when the loader from Windows starts loading that executable,
mm-hmm.
he'll be aware of the existence of it and will honor it. Like it knows, oh, it needs this assembly, and then it goes and tries to find that assembly.
Sure.
So this is how this works. Now, when we deploy that, one interesting scenario is for RTM, this is basically what we have. Now, when servicing happens, okay, we release a new VC libs,
mm-hmm.
okay, and that includes headers, report libraries, and DLLs. They are binary compatible, but they have a different version.
Mm.
Okay, so let's say that other version is CRT like 4. And CRT4. Okay? And in that case, if we place that new assembly, which is 4, with this that's asking for 3, it won't work because
mm.
he's asking for a version that's 3 and the new one is 4. So the mechanism that Fusion actually introduced to solve this problem is the policy assembly,
mm.
which is another assembly that we provide as part of the VC libs. So it's like running out of space. So it's policy, okay, and it contains also a manifest, okay, and it goes always with the same version, so it's CRT, let's say 3, and then here the directional policy, let's say it's anything is asking, anybody who's asking for 3 can use 3. It's really meaningless in this case.
Mm.
Okay, however, when we release the servicing, okay, those ones will look like so for CRT4, okay, it will look something like the manifest will be CRT4, and the policy will be saying and instead of 3 goes to 3, we'll say a range, so 3 to 4
mm-hmm.
should be using 4.
Okay.
And in that case, if this new piece is put along with this piece, then this 3 will fall in this range, and it will be redirected to 4, which is what we want.
Hmm.
So this is how this works. And the way Fusion does it is, once it loads the executable, it knows that it has a manifest. It knows it looks for version CRT3. Okay, so it goes into the Fusion cache, and looks for the most recent policy for the CRT assembly. So it finds that, oh, I have one that is for 4, and checks, can this policy redirect the version I'm asking for?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if it can redirect it, it will use the redirection. If it can't, then it will look in the same folder for an assembly that satisfies the request.
So in the case when we were talking earlier about 9 versus 10, it would fail, right? Or, or am I confusing the issue here?
So in 10...
Which would be totally possible.
So 9 to 10, it's actually considered a different assembly completely.
Okay, so we're talking about just version. Like, so down
exactly.
Here we're talking about policy versions. So
exactly. So policy versions only work within the same assembly boundaries.
Understood.
So it's kind of interesting how they're doing it. For example, in Fusion, the way we do the versioning, we have major number and minor number.
Mm.
Okay, and those if we change either of these two, okay, it's a completely different assembly. We can't do redirection between them. And then comes after that, like the build number, which is the 5-digit number that we always use.
Mm.
And this is where we can do the reversioning, or like the redirections between versions. So this is basically how it's implemented in the code. It's actually pretty simple.
Mm.
And those headers, this information, if anybody wants to see where they are, it's called usually like lib asm.h. So it will be like CRT asm.h or MFC asm.h.
Okay.
This information will be there. Now, another thing that comes to mind when we're looking at this is, let's say we have a third-party library. Okay, and this third-party comes with its own OBJ files and lib files. Okay, and then the user links those guys with the rest of his code, with the MFC library or CRT or whatever,
mm-hmm.
into this. Now, some users ran into a problem where basically those pieces contained information about also CRT. So if those have CRT 3 and CRT 3, okay, then everybody will be happy because those pieces depend on CRT 3, those pieces depend on CRT 3. Here we'll end up with manifest with a dependency, with one dependency on CRT 3.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody is consistent, there is no conflict. In some cases, especially happens when we release beta and like beta 2,
mm-hmm.
okay, where people start picking, let's say, the beta version of our libraries, but
mm-hmm.
their third-party library is still on the previous RTM, for example. So in that case, their OBJ and lib files will contain references to older CRT. And then here they end up with a new one, so we end up eventually here with 2 dependencies.
Mm.
Okay. And this is really bad. It's not really supported that you have like the same executable depending
mm-hmm.
on multiple versions of the VC.
Sure.
And the question is like they ask is like, oh, how come I ended up with these 2 versions? I don't
mm-hmm.
know where they came from. So if we go back in this, okay, basically we'll have to inspect first the OBJ files we're linking and the lib files we're linking into the final image. And the easiest way, without even learning any new command line or anything, if
mm-hmm.
we do just a text search on those guys, we can find the offending version. For example, if I have here CRT3, of course it should be more complex than that. Like let's say 3101,
mm-hmm.
and then we have 4101.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if I don't know where, so I know 30101 is coming from the library I just installed, so
mm-hmm.
I understand this part, but I don't know where this version is coming from.
Yeah.
So I would basically look at everything that I'm linking and do even a find str on it to see where it's coming from. And then in that way, I know at least which object in that case or library is bringing them in. In that case, I can either ask for an upgrade for that library
mm-hmm.
or maybe I shouldn't be upgrading at this point until I get the third party.
Interesting. So, I mean, why? Just out of curiosity, I mean, why can't that be determined by the linker?
So, actually, the linker emits some warnings
okay.
and catches some of the cases,
uh-huh.
but it doesn't catch all cases. Like, there are some corner cases that are not really reported by the linker.
Okay.
But it actually, like, I actually didn't know that until recently when I checked with somebody in the linker team, and they
mm-hmm.
said, like, we actually do detect some of the scenarios.
Nice.
So
we just don't document it. No, I'm just kidding.
Or it might be a warning and not an error, so you
sure.
end up never seeing it, like, because you don't read through your build logs every day. So.
Yeah.
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 So, yeah, so that's basically how it works.
Wow, very interesting. So now let's talk about, I know that, you know, what happens when it doesn't work?
So, I mean, there's a lot of ways. It's kind of complex. It might not work. But, I mean, the most common one is always people don't deploy the DLLs and they just try running their XE on their new computer and they're like, what? I didn't know I had to do anything. So that's the typical, you know, first user thing where they, or first experience using it. You're like, oh, I didn't know I had to redistribute anything. Unfortunately, I mean, the way things are now, we're sort of dependent on the Windows loader for what happens then, and they emit an error message. It's, I think, different on different machines, and it's different if you run it on the command line or not. I mean, sometimes it will say there's been a problem with
like, sometimes it says just, like, cannot find one of the program dependencies. It doesn't say which dependencies or anything.
Yeah.
And sometimes it even says, like, cannot execute the specified program,
yes.
which is...
Also,
much different.
Yeah, or sometimes when SXS error, it will say. When.
Mm.
But it's usually very nonspecific about what exactly the error was.
Now, does the loader really know what's going on? It's just not surfacing that information, right? Is it writing to the event log to make useful...
Yeah, so the loader actually... I'm not familiar with how exactly the loader is coupled with Fusion.
Mm.
But I know that at least Loader will be talking to Fusion, and Fusion has all the details, actually, of what it tried to do, and it failed. And the event log is actually one of the things that that has information about what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely this is the first place to look at if, like, one runs an application executable, it doesn't run, I go to the event log on any OS, like XP or Vista or after that. And look for events on the event log. There is a better tool, actually, that is unfortunately only supported on Vista.
Mm-hmm.
And that will basically dump all what Fusion was trying to do. So it will say, okay, I'm loading this application, and this application requires this version of this assembly. And then after that, it will say, okay, I'm looking into the assembly cache. I found these versions or
mm-hmm.
these policy redirections. And it goes step by step with a lot of detail.
Yeah.
And that tool is called sxstrace.exe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's available on any Vista machine. So
cool.
This is extremely useful.
Sure. Well, it's part of the, you know, Vista doesn't get the credit for the amount of telemetry that's been built into the system. And we've tried to talk about it and evangelize that on Channel 9, but it's just not something that users get excited about. The underlying system is a lot better at describing what went wrong in Vista. It's a serious operating system improvement,
yes,
but that's a sidetrack.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely way better than what we had before. Like before, like even like the error we get in the event log is basically saying which assembly failed,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't say why it failed. So comparing that to Vista, it's definitely a huge improvement.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, yeah. And then one other thing that makes it confusing to diagnose is oftentimes, I mean, the VC libraries are fairly common things to get distributed. I mean, the Office uses it, Windows uses some of them. So you'll see on some of your machines it will work and some it won't, and you'll be like, what's going on? So in that sense, that's definitely something where, you know, thinking about this problem in the future, like, you know, there's sort of directions we could go to
mm-hmm.
sort of make it less painful for people.
So, I mean, I guess one of the questions I'd ask is if you're, I mean, you know, we work at Microsoft. I mean, Visual C++ team works at Microsoft. And all of the companies, all of the groups around the company use your tools to build their products. You mentioned Office, Windows. I mean, not all developers necessarily going to be using VC++, the IDE, but they're going to be using your engine, they're going to be using
sure.
the linker, they're using the compiler.
Yeah.
So, you know, why wouldn't we just put these libraries on and built into to our operating systems or have Office install them so that everyone can use them? I mean, is that...
Yeah. Well, I mean, not everyone has Office, so that...
Fair enough.
So, but you're dealing with a problem of time, I think, really.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, we could put it on Vista, but we can't go back in time and put it on XP. I mean, we could release a Windows update, and that's one of the things we're definitely investigating doing that will add it to machines. But first of all, we can't make that a required update because, you know, people are going to say, why is this required? You're just installing things on my machine that I don't actually need because I have no programs that use it, for instance. Mm-hmm. So not every machine will have it, and not every machine, you know, connects up to the net necessarily. I mean, so we're obviously thinking about, you know, what can we do for, you know, future versions, and those are some steps we could take. But you can sort of think about, I mean, this is really sort of a non-ideal scenario, because basically the situation we're in where we have something that's common to a lot of programs are going to use it. It only really needs to get distributed once to each user, and it really only needs to get installed once for each user. So, and, I mean, none of these things are things we're implementing yet, but, like, one of the things people think about on the team is, like, well, maybe what we should do is write a little bit of startup code and make this easier for people. So instead, we delay load all our libraries instead. So say we're delay loading even the CRT, which is the base of everything. So in the startup code, we just say we look for the CRT DLL. Mm-hmm. And then if it's not there, we're like, oh, we know it's not there. Why don't we prompt the user to download it from Windows Update? Or why don't we even launch Windows Update to download the DLL? And what that sort of means in the end is that users just ship their exes and nothing else. And only one time will all their users ever have to install the CRT for any given version once one of their applications depends on it. Because then it'll install on the machine, and then every other application subsequently will detect its presence already and won't have to install it. So. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's sort of the scenario we'd love to move towards.
But that assumes that every client's connected to the internet.
It assumes that. It assumes a couple of things. It assumes they have administrator privileges, so they can install things centrally on them into Windows side by side. And you know, it's potentially breaking people who are dependent on DLL load order or things like that. So I think we're not losing all of this stuff.
Sure.
But we can certainly make the central scenario the one that's most easily discoverable and very low overhead for most users who are connected to the internet.
Sure. Well, I mean, deployment is a problem that everyone, all developers face.
Exactly.
And, you know, arguably a C++ application architecturally is going to be more complicated than where we are now in the .NET world.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so now that you clearly C++ is a language, you have a lot of developers out there. It's, again, all the major products of Microsoft are written in this language.
Sure.
And will continue to be for a while.
.NET is itself. You know,
exactly.
The
CLR is written
runs on
in
the CRT. So.
the point is, you know, you're going to evolve the complexity because this is a roadmap to DLL hell in some instances.
Yeah.
You've just kind of shown us the fingerprint of DLL hell. So, but you guys are obviously innovating and working on making it easier. I mean, Windows side by side is an interesting solution that's come about in the recent past.
Yeah.
And you're moving more.
Yes, there is complexity in how it's working.
Mm-hmm.
Although that wasn't, of course, the intention to transfer that complexity to the end user by any means.
Yes.
So I think, like with Fusion, we did achieve a few things, like, for example, the ability to update things centrally as something that's valuable. The fact that we installed to the Windows cache, okay, this actually requires certain criteria for DLLs to be installed, like being signed by a known signer, and all of this guarantees some level of security that wasn't there, was just regular DLLs that we dropped.
Sure.
And also the way the versioning is done, and how the user's application is bound to the runtime it was built with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe it's complex, but then it guarantees at least that there shouldn't be any cases where the wrong DLL is loaded,
mm-hmm.
and the application is not anticipating that other wrong DLL like what used to happen. So to some degree, we've restricted which DLLs can be loaded.
Cool.
And it's kind of interesting because even though our purpose was to make sure that we are loading the right DLL, okay, I think in some cases this fired back in the sense where people wanted more actually flexibility. And like, well, I don't want to have to worry about all this versioning and all of this. I just want to load the DLL.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of very hard to make the balance between the very safe and secure scenario where we know exactly what you're loading
mm-hmm.
and the more easier deployment scenarios. Like, for example, the xcopy scenario is always a favorable one. Like, we just copy the stuff, it works. But then it has its own drawbacks as well.
Of course.
So,
and the drawbacks hit the people who use the system or using the application. I mean, there can really be no compromise these days with security.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
End of story. I mean, it's a hard problem that you guys are facing, though, because you are the unmanaged world. But you can still be secure.
Yes.
Sure. Yeah. And, when we're talking about complexity, yes, it is complex, but it's because we're allowing people to do things that they can't do with .NET. That, I mean, we can make it simple, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can erase everything but one thing on this board.
Mm-hmm.
But then people are going to become unhappy with that. And that's sort of the C++ world. You can do just about anything in this world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can write managed code, you can write native code, but it's more complicated because you have to make decisions about what you're going to do, and to make those decisions, you have to become informed enough to make those decisions, or you have to arbitrarily choose one. And in that sense, there's a lot more breadth to deal with and things you have to think about than sort of, I don't want to say it's a managed thing. I don't want to say it's a younger thing. Like, a younger product where there are fewer options is always going to be easier to deal with. So
mm-hmm.
The balance is always, what are you getting from the complexity, and is it worth it?
Sure.
So,
yeah. And that's why, actually, because of this breadth that we have in the library and the too many options that we already have,
mm-hmm.
it's always good to hear feedback about what people really... which scenarios really fit people's needs. Like, how important, for example, is the app local scenario compared to the central scenario? We know that from a security perspective, that the central, the deployment scenario is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But how important is the other scenarios? How many people are using it? So it's always good to hear feedback about what people run into. So
sure.
That will always clarify which ones we should make easier. And those scenarios.
Yes.
Well, you have a vibrant community. I'm sure you get plenty of feedback.
Yes.
Lots of detail.
Part of the problem about feedback is you'll get every position that's possible. You'll be like, no, this one, only that one. And determining, you know, who to listen to is almost a challenge in and of itself.
Sure.
So.
But I think there's work there's work that could be done at the tools level.
Yeah.
To
and
make this easier.
Yeah. And we're really,
yes.
really open to... I mean, this is one of our priorities for future versions of VC, and we're really open to that type of feedback about, you know, where people are having issues and you know, what they'd like to see made easier, what they'd like to be seeing made differently. And some things we obviously can do and some we can't, but it's great to hear from people on Channel 9, and we've done blog posts in the past on VC Blog about the same issue. About what they hit and you know, how things are going. So we obviously hear about how things are going wrong because people don't realize it. You know, it's transparent when it's going right. But so this is an area we're looking at working on. So
cool. So I mean, you know, part of Channel 9 is to look at the humans in front of the camera. I guess one of the questions that asked me, we've been focusing pretty deeply on technology. You know, why did you get into this madness? I mean, why are you in the C++ team? What is it that you love about this technology and doing what you do? Man?
So C++ in general, like the VC team, since like I was maybe in middle school or something like that, I started hearing about this powerful language, so that was like in early 90s.
Mm.
Powerful language that you basically can do anything with it, and it's very close to the machine, so it's a very clean mapping of the machine we're actually dealing with.
Mm.
So I really got into liking this power from the very beginning, and then somehow, long story, I ended up on the Visual Studio and the VC team, and this is exactly what we're doing. Like, we still have this power until this day.
Mm-hmm.
And for Fusion particularly, it's one thing that adds value to the library, and then we include it in the library, and it became part of the thing we need to make work for the people, basically for the users.
Excellent.
So
very cool.
Sure.
Yeah, and I mean, I think for similar reasons to George, I mean, it's not just a language that is, you know, down to the metal, and you know, you can do any level of abstraction you want with it, but it's also, I mean, if you think about what depends on Visual C++, like is it on a team in Microsoft, almost everything in Microsoft at some level will depend on the C++ runtime. Almost any application built for Windows will, even if you know they're using .NET uses the C runtime. So you're sort of, to make an improvement here, say you make like a 0.1% performance improvement in something, multiply that 0.1% improvement performance improvement by every single application ever, and it's a huge difference you can make on this team. So in that sense, it's kind of a cool team to work on. I mean, you can get as technical as you want within this team, and not just that, but you can go higher level into things like MFC and ATL libraries, the IDE. So, I mean, that's great. I mean, to be honest, I mean, one of the reasons I'm on this team is actually because of the college recruiting process at Microsoft, where they
really,
you know, well, 2 years ago, you know, when I applied here, I sent in my resume. 6 months later, I hear back from them, and I get phoned in, and like that day is when I found out what teams I was interviewing on. It's very non-directive. They sort of, I don't know if it's still like that.
Yeah, I think it is actually.
Oh, really?
So that keeps it interesting. Huh?
Yeah. So I mean, that's really one of the reasons I'm on this team, to be honest. But I mean, I got offers from everything I interviewed that day, and I came back again and interviewed for other teams. Like once you get an offer, they're more willing to,
yeah,
to let you be more directive in what you want to do. But I mean, I came to this team, you know, for that reason. So
cool.
And I mean, what better place to start? What you learn here isn't going to be useful pretty much wherever you go.
Of course. So. Great. Well, hey, it's great to talk to you and meet you guys. As always, it's nice to learn about the, you know, the insides of what's going on in the system, and C++ is a good way to learn about that. And it's also interesting the work you guys have ahead of you for making deployment easy. So it,
yes,
should be fun to, you know, when you try to do your new ideas, and then you're going to come along and you're going to crack them and break them.
Sure.
And then you're,
yes,
going to have that interesting developer.
I
mean, you're both developers.
Yeah.
Just one cracks and one,
yes,
tries to fix, and then outstanding.
Yep.
Cool. Well, it's great to meet you guys.
Cool.
And we'll come
good
back and talk to you again.
Great. Yeah.